Hi, I'm Susie Burrell.
And I'm Leanne Ward.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we see health halos trending in the media. What are they? And are you making this mistake when you're buying your food products? We look at MTHFR gene mutations, also known as the mother of all genes. What are they and how can they impact your health, your fertility, the way you eat? And we break down the research to show you the interesting genetic area that impacts our diet. A product review is about a low sugar granola that you are going to love. And our listener question is one close to many of our hearts, chocolate. Can we still enjoy our favorite chocolate every day, but still be healthy? But to kick us off, Leanne, what has been happening up north this week?
Oh, up north. I'm looking out the window, Susie. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining. It's pretty good. We've had a few westerly winds up here, so it's been a bit windy and blowy over the weekend. But otherwise, what else besides the weather? We've still got our mask rule mandate here. So if we're going out, if we're going to the gym, we've still got masks on. So there's still a few cases popping up here and there, but we're faring a little bit better than, unfortunately, Sydney is at the moment. How are you guys going down there?
We're okay. I think we're plodding on, but I think we've missed another big fact. We all want to have a pregnancy update this week. What week are we up to and how have you been feeling?
We're week 18 this week. Not feeling too bad, just feeling constantly bloated. I think I was saying to you, I have trouble just sitting down. If I slouch over, I have to really sit up straight on purpose because I just feel like I'm constantly bloated, eating more small frequent meals than larger meals, which I'm used to. So lots of snacking going on. But yeah, otherwise, not feeling too bad. Energy is not too bad this week. So been good, being able to exercise as well, which has been nice.
And of course, we'll pop up some bump photos because everyone loves a bump photo. But I think when I think of you and having a baby, you're so very tall. And I just remember midwife Kath, who's very well known in this space. And when I had my twins 5 years ago, she was like the guru of pregnancy. And it just always stuck in my mind that she said at a talk I went to that people who were tall, pretty tall girls, tended to have easier pregnancies and easier births because the way their bodies were made, it just was a lot easier to hold and carry and push out, for want of a better word, a baby. And I always think to myself, I was exactly the opposite. So lucky I had a scheduled cesarean section with the twins. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how you go, because if you're already feeling a bit full, it's always good when we're dealing with clients when you've lived it. We always come back with different recommendations. So we'll have Leanne before baby and then Leanne's advice after baby to be running off. So I'm pretty excited about this next few months. So as many of our listeners are, so thank you for your lovely well wishes. We love seeing them and we will pop a bump update picture each week as well so you can see the progression. If Leanne's happy, I haven't checked that with her yet. She's just looking at me as if to say thanks for that.
If that's what our listeners want, that is what our listeners can have, Susie. I'm not shy about that. There'll be plenty of bump updates on my Instagram as the months go on, I'm sure.
Very
exciting. But at the moment, it's easy just to wear track pants during winter. It's been pretty hard to hide pregnancy in the early days, just big baggy jumpers and track pants. But I mean, it's not starting to warm up just yet, but I'm going to have to get some stretchy jeans and some more elastic clothes, I think, for the summer months. Big flowy dresses.
Well, if anyone hasn't seen Leanne's own Instagram site, The Fitness Dietitian, you'll know she has abs. So Leanne actually has abs. So it will be interesting to see what's happening to those abs. But I am going to move on because it is not a pregnancy podcast, but sorry, I'm getting distracted. And we'll keep focused on The Nutrition Couch podcast for now. So to get us started this week, one topic that came up in the media was a concept of health halos, which resonated with both of us because we see it a lot in our work. So we thought it was a worthy discussion of what is a health halo and how does it impact our day-to-day food. And I guess in easy summary is a lot of us are aware that things like carrot sticks and celery sticks are healthier than chocolates and lollies when it comes to snack food. But sometimes there can be some really subtle differences between a couple of different products in the supermarket, and one may get labeled good or a healthier choice, and then the other just gets thrown aside as a bad or unhealthy option. And the interesting thing is that when different foods find their way into that health food section of the supermarket or with that health halo attached, sometimes it can be just really clever marketing, and these foods may be praised for being better for us, but we actually maybe don't know why. And when we look at the ingredient list or the foods, it might include things like coconut oil, organic raw sugar, agave, rice malt syrup, of course, was the big one a few years back, pink or Himalayan sea salt. And we thought it worthy of a discussion because a lot of our products that we're interested in do come from the health food section of the supermarket. indeed, there's a perception that sometimes very processed foods can be healthier because they exist here. And we thought it would be a nice point of discussion for everyone this week. And Leanne, what do you think? Health halos, where do they come into your work and what are your thoughts on them?
Yeah, I think I've seen a big trend in health halos over the last few years because I think consumers are very busy. There's a whole aisle in terms of the health food section at the supermarket. It's no longer just a little shelf or a little corner in the supermarket anymore. Like, there's an entire aisle dedicated to the health food section. And when I think of health halos, Susie, I think low fat, I think organic, I think paleo, no added sugar, high protein, baked not fried, made with real fruit. All of these are just, for lack of a better word, clever marketing claims for most companies. Like, I've seen children's products packed full of sugar, but it's got made with real fruit, or it's got no added sugar on the front of the packet, which doesn't mean that it's sugar-free. It may have a ton of sugar still there, but the real fruit might be like fruit juice concentrate, or it might be 2% blueberries, and then it's like another, you know, 50 grams of sugar in that as well. And same deal with, you know, organic. I've had clients say to me, oh, I love this brand of corn chips because they're organic corn chips. And it's like, okay, that's cool, it's organic corn, but it doesn't necessarily make it any healthier. And same with, you know, the range of high protein. There's high protein chocolates, high protein cookies, high protein muesli bars. It's like, are they actually any healthier despite having a little bit more protein in there? And yes, we understand protein is important for a healthy lifestyle, but I think we've just gone a little bit protein crazy in the marketing of foods these days. And baked not fried is another really good one. You look at a bag of potato chips or a bag of, you know, crackers, baked not fried still has relatively the same amount of fat in it that another normal bag of potato chips has, but people will grab it thinking that that's a healthier option. My dad did this the other day. We went over and watched the State of Origin with him, Susie. It was very depressing for Queenslanders, but he was very proud of himself that he's like, oh, I picked up some snacks, and he threw me a bag of the Smith's baked not fried chips. And I was like, oh, I didn't have the heart to tell him, like, he was really trying. And he was like, what do you think? And I was like, oh yeah, like, that, you know, they're super tasty, and just kind of left it at that. But when I actually compared them to the normal bag of Smith's chips, they weren't actually any healthier. So I think that these marketing labels are something we really, really need to pay attention to. And I've always said to my clients, don't even worry about the front of the package marketing or the health claims or the health halos say. Flip it over, read the ingredient list, and actually do a proper comparison compared to, you know, the quote unquote normal product on the market.
I really love those baked dot fried chips, can I say, particularly the salt and vinegar. But they do have a really high calorie load. So yes, 100%. I think the products that it comes up for me are protein bars and protein balls in particular, mm-hmm. and often gluten-free products, because they for a long time have been painted with a health brush. And often, as we know, they're more heavily processed than non-gluten products. I think by way of historical value, the reason that foods end up in the health food section doesn't necessarily have anything to do with their nutrient composition. It will depend on a negotiation between the manufacturer and the buyer of the supermarket. And keep in mind that supermarket buyers are incredibly powerful human beings. They are driven by sales targets, by positioning, by how much companies are prepared to pay, the power of the company in the overall scheme of the supermarket, what the supermarket brands are doing with their own health food aisle, what's selling well. They will adjust that based on consumer demand, not nutritional characteristics. That's really, really important. The only take-home message I would give to people is, if you look at an ingredient list and there's 20 plus ingredients on that label, chances are it's not very healthy. It's indicative of how processed the food is. And as we know, highly processed foods are the worst for us when it comes to long-term health and inflammation in the body. And so, sure, you may have a specific allergy or food intolerance that you're looking for in those sections, but in general, if it sounds too good to be true and it's healthier chocolate or healthier biscuits or foods that are generally not healthy, they're probably not significantly better for you and need to be consumed in that control amount, as we would suggest any processed food be. And that is just the way it works out. Dietitians and nutritionists don't run the health food aisle. It's dictated by consumer demand and food trends, which are driven by often companies that have an interest in marketing that for specific reasons. And for some time, it's definitely been protein has had that health halo. Vegan plant-based foods at the moment, I think it's the greatest area of growth in supermarket. And then, of course, you go to the muesli bar section or even the potato chip section, as you described, and we'll see those kind of products described for lunchbox-friendly options. So I just paint them with all a brush of processed food and try and include as little of it as you can. And most of the packaging on product or even the way product looks will be dictated by marketing and consumer perception rather than the science. And the science will come down purely to the ingredient list and the nutritional panel. That's the only thing you can take as a true representation of a healthy food.
And I think a really interesting one as well, which I see is really making its way in the supermarkets in the last few months, Susie, is the no added sugar, all the sugar-free options. And I think it's quite amusing because the sugar-free is generally no added, like refined sugar, so basically no white sugar added. But if you look at a lot of these sugar-free biscuits and cakes and that sort of thing, some of them aren't necessarily sugar-free. A lot of them have honey as the sugar type, or a lot of them have agave syrup as the sugar type. So they still have a ton of sugar in them. They're no different, but it's just they're not using, you know, white sugar. Or another health halo is something like raw brown sugar. The amount of clients that say to me, oh, I don't add white sugar to my tea, but I have 2 or 3 teaspoons of raw brown organic sugar, thinking that that is healthier because it's, I don't know, it's raw, it's brown, it's organic, right? So just really watching those health halos without it even being a processed food, like raw brown organic sugar probably has one ingredient in it. Same deal with some of our oils. You know, people think that coconut oil is superior to something like extra virgin olive oil, or people are spending 4 times the amount on pink Himalayan sea salt versus just, you know, normal ionized table salt or something like that. So I think there are a lot of products scattered through the supermarket that probably cost 2, 3, 4 times as much. But if we look at the actual health benefit at the end of the day, maybe a small percentage of benefit, but perhaps when it comes down to weighing the cost of it, probably not really going to make a huge impact based on the additional costs.
No, and I think about the products that I myself would buy or recommend clients access there. Just off the top of my head, the only ones I point towards, there's a couple of nut and seed products which tend to be sold there, because if you think about nuts in the supermarket, they're kind of sometimes sold in the baking section. So I can understand why some snack food companies position. I'm thinking of the Munch Bites, you know, the pumpkin seed Munch Bites.
Yeah.
That's one product, or the roasted broad beans from the Happy Snack Food Company that are particularly healthy. I don't mind the Messy Monkeys for kids, the kind of little flavoured. There's a couple of brown rice cake options, and definitely the Woolworths brand of beetroot bites or pumpkin bites are nutritionally quite good. But in general, there would be very, very few products that I would point towards and think that they're healthier. And when it comes to things like the protein cookies and protein balls and protein bars, they can taste great. And as we've discussed before, calorie-wise, they can be more like a cake at 200-300 calories per serve. And the serve may be as little as 30 to 40 grams. But you know the reason that I don't buy them or recommend them? Because they're so expensive. Like that's, you know, $3 or $4 minimum per snack. Like most people that I'm speaking to are on a food budget. They don't want to be spending that much on a one-off snack that, you know, it doesn't fit into a household budget, nor would I expect my clients to be spending that much when they could have cheese and crackers or a yogurt for half as much with a lot more nutrition overall. And as I said, the easiest way to determine if you're looking at that ingredient list and it's really long, it's heavily processed, and most likely we wouldn't really be suggesting it as a regular food product, more of a one-off or if you really liked it, but not something I generally recommend families buy as part of the routine supermarket shop.
Definitely agree there. So very interesting in terms of our health halos, and can see why the media has picked that one up this week, Susie. And now another topic of interest in our clinics this week, and we've had quite a few clients bringing us this, I guess, this topic around genetic mutation for the last couple of, I'd say, months either. So the MTHFR mutation, it's been coming up a lot in our clinic, Susie. I'm sure a lot of people have heard about it, or as we like to call it, the mother gene mutation, Susie. I'm going to throw this one to you. This is really definitely your area of expertise and not mine. So what can you tell our listeners about this specific gene?
So I became aware of MTHFR mutations probably about 5 years ago, and I can't remember exactly why. It was probably because a client had come and said that they'd had this genetic mutation, and I had myself had been tested for it with my GP because I had been doing some fertility stuff, and it had come up that I myself had this mutation. Now, at the most general form of it, it's a gene mutation that's relatively common, and as such, we've only been sort of testing for it in more recent years. And it's a gene that is involved in producing an enzyme that metabolizes folate. Now, folate is a B group vitamin, vitamin B9. People who are trying to conceive or having nutrition for fertility will be interested sometimes in folate because, of course, there have been recommendations to prevent neural tube defects to take folate supplement to make sure you've got enough of that key nutrient. Now, this particular gene mutation, and I'll talk in a minute about the couple that exist, specifically it is this enzyme which converts folate in our bodies into a form of folate that can be actually active and used in a number of metabolic processes. It's heavily involved in inflammatory pathways, our stress response, energy metabolism, and specifically the synthesis of DNA, and hence the link to new cell development and potential miscarriage if there are issues with this gene. And one of the genes specifically is closely linked to inflammation and elevated homocysteine, which can have a number of implications for heart disease risk factors and type 2 diabetes. So a few years ago, working with an endocrinologist, and I gave a presentation on this gene mutation, and he was older and he was about to retire, and he said to in front of the doctors, well, I've never heard of it. I don't believe in it. But I think the more we come to learn about these pathways and understand we don't know everything, the more we are identifying things like this mutation that can have quite profound effects on folate pathways. So there are two of these genes, one C677T and one is A1298C. People can have one of those, they can have two, or they can have one of each. And the number of genes, whether you have two, and so a homozygous for that gene, can lead to more pronounced symptoms as opposed to having just one. And it is associated with an increase, I wouldn't say risk, an increased chance of having multiples, which perhaps might explain that I have this gene mutation myself and, of course, have had twins and a history of twins in my family. But from a daily perspective, when we're dealing with clients, the reason that it comes up for me is that there are general recommendations for people who are wanting to have children, had a history of miscarriage or fertility issues, to supplement, of course, with folate, and quite high amounts of folate. But what we know is that that form of folate, for the people who have this gene mutation, they may not be able to metabolize it very well. And so the recommendation is if you have one or two of these gene mutations, you really need to be what we call on a methylated folate. So the folate is in its active form and can be metabolized in the body. So it's quite a simple follow-on effect. If you have it, it basically means the type of folate that you should supplement with should be different. And indeed, one of the dietitians we both know very well, Mel McGrice, who is an expert in fertility nutrition, will often talk about it in her experience and working with people who are dealing with pregnancy-related issues or fertility-related issues. But the thing that comes up for me, and this is the link specifically to diet, is that if I have someone who presents in my office and they may have had a history of fertility issues or miscarriage, or in their family have heart disease, increased levels of inflammation, very, very fatigued and tired, and also have insulin resistance, sometimes I will ask to see if they have these gene mutations, because what I want to know is that if they're consuming breads and cereals that are all fortified with folate in our food supply, and this is potentially a type of folate that they can't metabolize well, is it actually doing them more damage by having that supplementary food in their diet? And as such, would they be better on a gluten-free diet? Because of course, gluten-free products are not fortified with this form of folate they potentially cannot metabolize. And so indeed, if I have a client who comes in and one, they're trying to have a baby or planning to, straight away, I want to know if they potentially have this gene mutation, one or both. And as such, would be giving a different recommendation on the type of folate they should be supplementing their diet with. Or if they have some gut disturbance and some of the other symptoms, specifically high homocysteine, instantly I would suggest they start on a gluten-free diet. Not because they've got an issue with gluten, but because the gluten-free flour that they'll be incorporating in their diet won't have that form of folate fortified, which potentially they can't metabolize. Now, the other little interesting thing about this genetic mutation is that one is more pronounced linked to inflammation in the body, and that's the C677T gene. So they all operate quite differently. It's not a one size fits all, which is why you need to speak to a doctor or a dietitian who has experience in this before you eliminate gluten from your diet without knowing if you've got that specific mutation. But of interest to me was that natural folate, which of course we find in greatest concentrations in leafy green vegetables, and you would argue that as dietitians, we probably naturally consume loads and loads of these in our diet, is that it overrides the pathway naturally. So even if you have that gene mutation, simply making sure that you're having really high natural amounts of folates from several serves of leafy green veggies a day and natural forms of folate from fruits and vegetables will skip the pathway and you don't have this effect of perhaps not being able to metabolize the folate efficiently. And so I believe that's probably one of the reasons that I have never had myself any of these symptoms and had no issues, because naturally my diet would have been packed full of folate my whole time. Now, this is something not to be proud of, but I didn't actively supplement my diet when I was pregnant, not because I had it wasn't a decision. It was more that I'm not very good with taking things and often forgot. But in hindsight, you know, my diet would have been so packed with folate because I am a dietitian and eat such large volumes of fresh fruit and vegetables anyway. So one of the take-home messages for anyone listening who knows they have this mutation, is interested in it, who thinks, oh, hang on, I had a history of miscarriage and I have a little bit of gut disturbance and I feel really tired and there's no explanation, definitely I would ask to have the gene test done. I think it costs about $40 to see if you've got one gene, two genes, both genes, and as such may have a reduction in efficiency of folate metabolism estimated between 40 and 70%, and hence the link to energy production and fatigue. If you naturally, the best recommendation we can give you is before you go and rush and do a gluten-free diet or buy methylated folate, you've just got to eat a whole lot more green veggies, because naturally that will help to correct that pathway and help to make sure that you're at less risk of things like the symptoms, which can be fatigue or cell if you're thinking of getting pregnant. That's a natural recommendation. So that's my experience with MTHFR mutations. I'm by no means an expert. It's just by my clinical experience with it. And I think you have done a podcast looking at this on Leanne Ward Nutrition.
No, I haven't. I haven't. No, it's a very new area for me. Yeah.
It comes up though. It comes up in your discussion with people, doesn't it?
I think it has. Yeah. But I think we've only really brushed the surface on it. We've never really taken a deep dive into it, but it's an interesting one. Perhaps maybe I could get an expert on to chat further through. But with the testing, it's just a standard blood test through your doctor or GP, is it?
Yeah, very easy. $40. And it just tells you if you've got one or two of those. And absolutely, I think if you're symptomatic in the sense of, because of course, it tends to get more pronounced as we get older, because inflammation increases over time and your body's not as efficient as it once was. Perhaps your diet's not as good as it once was. You might gain weight, which of course increases inflammation and it kicks off all of these pathways. But of interest, Leanne, I think it's fun because people will say, oh, I've gone on a gluten-free diet and I feel better. So obviously it's a gluten issue, and it's not a gluten issue. It's a flour issue and the type of folate we're getting through the food supply if you're consuming breads and cereals that are, I've got that fortified flour, which all do to help prevent neural tube defects. But you would argue these are actually contraindicated depending on your genetic profile. So it's like all these areas, we are learning so much every single day, but it's relevant because for me as a dietitian, and the response to the doctor at that time when he said, I've never heard of it, is you only have to go back to your basic biochemical pathways to see the pronounced effect and the role folate plays in so many of our body systems. And if you have a gene mutation that would suggest you're not metabolizing that nutrient effectively, that's a huge problem. And it's also very easily fixed, whether it's by supplementation with the right type of supplement, by some simple changes to the diet. So as a take-home message, and I always say this with my clients, nobody knows your body better than you do. If you don't feel good, if you know something's not quite right, highly likely you're on the right path. And it's just a matter of weeding down and getting the right person and the right experts to follow that up. So those symptoms like unexplained gut low mood, digestion issues, ongoing fatigue that is unexplained, I would absolutely be looking at some of these areas because there is a growing pool of research and anecdotally a very reasonable explanation for why these symptoms may be presenting if you have these gene mutations.
Absolutely. Wonderful discussion. Thank you, Susie.
Right. So a bit lighter now. It's all been very heavy. On to our product review of the week. Now, when we came together to talk about this, we sort of thought, should we talk about oats because it's winter? But I thought I would really like to talk about granola because I love granola. I love to bake with it. I love when I go to America to try all the different ones. And there is a growing range of reduced sugar varieties of granola in the supermarket. And one that has just crossed our path recently is the Carmen's low sugar granola. And it's a really strong product and tastes pretty good. So the nutritionals, you can find it in all mainstream supermarkets. It comes in per serve at 4.5 grams of protein, which is pretty good for a cereal-based product. 2.1 grams of saturated fat, because sometimes great tasting granolas can be cooked in quite a lot of butter or oil, so the fat can be a little bit higher. It's only got 2.2 grams of sugar per 45-gram serve, or that's 4.8 grams per 100, so less than 5%. 7.7 grams of dietary fiber per serve, which is outstanding. And the main ingredients, whole grain oats and wheat, some chicory fiber, which is why we've got that higher fiber load, 9% seeds, which is really strong in bumping up the good fat component, a little bit of brown rice syrup to give a slight sweetness, some coconut, a little bit of sunflower oil in processing, quite small, freeze-dried raspberry, tapioca starch, some natural flavor. So on the whole, nutritionally, a very strong product. 20 grams of carb per serve, which ticks the box for people who are trying to keep their carbs controlled. You team that with some protein-based yogurt, some milk, some extra berries, and you've got a very nutritious, high-fiber, whole-grain product that's still giving you that sweetness and crunch and change around granola, which I think sometimes we're looking for, particularly if we're making up breakfast bowls. And baking, for me, I use them a lot with baking, whether it's cookies for the kids or using crumbles on the top of muffins. I'm a big fan. I really like them. And the feedback has been across the range of lower sugar granolas in supermarkets that they're pretty good nutritionally.
I must admit, I haven't tried it. I'm not a big cereal person for breakfast. I don't find it as filling, but it sounds very good and nutritionally it is quite strong. The serving size is quite standard. 45 grams for a cereal or granola is the standard serving size. And I think the reason that as dietitians we don't typically recommend granola is because it's typically quite high in sugar and quite high in fat. And they generally add, as you mentioned, like butters or oils, and they bake that so it's nice and like toasted and crunchy, but it's not necessarily a great product nutritionally. But this one is definitely a superior one in the market when it comes to granolas. And the addition of the chicory root fiber, I think, is really important as well. It's a natural type of prebiotic, so it's great for gut health. Just be wary if you do have IBS. It could be a little bit of a trigger for you if you are a bit sensitive. 7.7 grams of fiber in 45 grams is a high amount. So if you do find that you do feel quite bloated after that, or you're quite gassy, maybe just dial it back a little bit. Try a half portion of that and see how you go.
Because 45 grams is sort of just over a third of a cup if you're measuring it out. And I think the other point to make is that if you looked at the fat content of this, it would seem quite high, like at 16.4 per 100 grams, 16%. We generally recommend foods with less than about 10% fat, but it's a good example of where foods have got a whole grain and quite a few seeds and nuts. In some cases, it will bump up that fat component, which is why we're looking at a relatively low saturated fat content rather than total fat. So it's an example of how sometimes you're having foods like a whole grain bread, where it might have less carbohydrate, but as such, you're getting a little bit more fat. And as long as the fat is primarily coming from good fats, in the case of this product, 9% seeds from Pepita's linseed sunflower, you're on the right track with it. And if anything, it's probably more filling because you're getting that profile of some protein, little bit of carbohydrate, but also some good fat to slow down digestion. So when it comes to fat, it's about the type, not just how much fat in total that it's got. Because you could look at something like cornflakes. Cornflakes are really, really low in fat, but they're heavily processed, refined carbohydrate, and that will be digested very, very quickly, not great for blood glucose levels, not a lot of fiber. So when we're sort of rating a food, we're looking at the overall macronutrient profile, not just one-off things like fat or sugar. It's how the food comes together as a whole.
Exactly. It's where is that fat coming from, which is why it's so important to not worry about the claims on the front of the nutrition packet, but actually flip it over and have a read of the ingredient list and look at, you know, what are the top five ingredients that are featured heavily in this product. And whole grains, oats, wheat, chicory fiber, and the seeds are, you know, the top four or five ingredients, which are really, really strong nutritionally. Unfortunately for our celiacs, this isn't a product that is gluten-free, but for a lot of other people, they shouldn't have too many issues with it. There's no nuts listed in there, is it? We don't have access to the allergen panel.
No nuts. But it is, I would say that perhaps it would be processed in a factory with nuts, knowing the brand, highly likely. But the other tip I would give is that if you do love a granola cereal or any cereal and you're teaming it with a protein-rich product, whether it's some protein powder into a shake or making a smoothie bowl, is that you've got to measure your portions because it is relatively sweet tasting and yummy. It's so easy to eat more an extra spoon. So I would suggest sticking a measuring cup into the box and making sure you don't just have a little bit extra each day just to keep your portions under control.
45 grams can easily become 85 grams.
Very easily.
Yeah. Another tip that I use for a lot of my clients, Susie, is giving like a tablespoon or two of a granola. If clients love granola, before this good range of low sugar, high fiber granola came on the market, I'd use just a standard granola, which is a lot higher in sugar and fat, but I'd just give them a tablespoon on top of a high protein yogurt as a snack choice, maybe pre-workout or something like that. So that's another great way that if you really do enjoy granola, perhaps you're not a fan of this product, you love another one on the market, but nutritionally it's not as great, perhaps have a smaller amount as a snack choice with a really good whack of protein-based yogurt. And that's probably a really good way that you can continue to enjoy that without getting too much of that load of sugar and fat in at breakfast time.
No, I love that as a snack as well. And it's about getting that balance of a little bit of crunch with a plain yogurt. It's some berries, some vanilla essence, some cinnamon. It's a fantastic snack choice. I couldn't agree more.
Love it. And then our final segment while we're talking about food, Susie, will resonate with a lot of our listeners. Our listener question of the week is all about chocolates. How much chocolate can I eat? Can I eat it every day? And can I still be healthy? Susie, we're both chocolate lovers. You mentioned you found some chocolate in your office before we jumped on this podcast. I was very jealous. Baby me over here, very jealous. What are your thoughts on chocolate? Can we eat it every day? And can we still be healthy?
Oh, I did. I found some rum and raisin stuck behind my computer. I thought that's great for a little energy hit. Chocolate. Oh, we could talk all day about it. I think if you asked many listeners their favorite food, it would be close to the top of the list. And, you know, we're going to probably give a very general response here that maybe not resonate with everyone in the sense that really it comes down to moderation. It's one of those foods that, you know, is it high fat? Yes. Is it high calorie? Yes. Is it high sugar? Yes. Do the nutritional benefits outweigh the negatives? I don't think so, although I will share a recent study that was published with postmenopausal women. And in the study, they were required, the women, to have 100 grams of chocolate within an hour of waking or 100 grams of chocolate within an hour going to bed. So literally they were given permission to have quite a fair whack. Like that's more than half a block of that, the chocolate that sells now, I think at 185 grams in supermarkets. It's a fair, like it's three or four rows. It's a fair whack. And the study found that they didn't gain weight. It found that they ate less in the day, they exercised more, and they actually metabolized more fat. And it was done on milk chocolate, not dark chocolate, which we often hear about research being done on. And my message, take-home message from that was that I think a lot of us cognitively control our food intake. And so even though we think we're not having very much, we end up overeating it because we've controlled it and thought we shouldn't have it. Whereas in this study, they were given permission to have quite large volumes. And as such, they regulated accordingly. So my message for clients with chocolate is, if you are someone who cannot control yourself and you buy a block and means you will eat a block, I would severely limit the portions you have in the home because you will overeat it. And it's very easy to overeat. And we tend to eat it at night. And of course, that's the worst time to have it. It's when we're about to go to sleep. It's bad for blood glucose regulation. And we also know from programming research, the more you have, the more you want. If you have a Mars bar every day at 4, by the third day, your brain is looking for that Mars bar. So it's easily programmable. And so the more you have, the more you will want. On the other hand, if you're a good regulator, as I would say, as I've got older, I'm a lot better, I can have a block there and not eat it. Admittedly, I probably eat two or three rows instead of one, which is generally a serve of about 100 calories. But if you can limit yourself to a biscuit or two or a row or two, sure, you know, include it. But that is as you would describe your soul food. You don't get to have that plus dessert, plus wine. You've got to have it as that extra high calorie food that by, let's be honest, probably 200 extra calories if we're reasonable about the portion sizes, like a reasonable size Freddo or chocolate bar. Mm-hmm. Most of them are about 200 calories. So it really will depend. But I would say go for the chocolate you really feel like and spend that time thinking, what do I actually really want? Do I want something that's got lollies in it? Am I looking for something that's, you know, dark chocolate and that's going to be satisfying because it's about spending the time enjoying it. Whereas people eat on auto cue and they get the block and they eat it without even tasting it. And I would say the key is to be very mindful when you're enjoying the chocolate that you love, eating it slowly, savoring it, and training yourself to get more pleasure from less rather than playing mind games where you avoid it, you restrict it, and then you binge. Mm-hmm. And that's the behavior we want to get control over. And I'm much more comfortable for my clients to include it and be able to regulate than to avoid, and binge. But it can be a process. If you have avoided and cognitively restricted your food intake for 30 years of your life, it's not going to change within a week. It'll be something you have to work on. But getting control over it and not feeling an emotional pull when you walk down the chocolate aisle is a very strong position to be in. And it's one with food that would be nice to be in control of it rather than constantly playing mind games around good food and bad food and food that you think you shouldn't be having.
Absolutely. And if you're going to have it every day, like it's, you know, it can be part of a healthy lifestyle. As we mentioned, if that's sort of your only soul food for the day, if you're somebody that has the donut or the cake or something most morning teas or for afternoon tea, you know, you're having a little bit of extra chocolate or perhaps you're doing the cafe run with the kids and you're getting some banana bread or a muffin or you're having dessert for dinner most nights or you're having a glass of wine two or three times a week, those things, they can't all go together, particularly if you're trying to live a healthy lifestyle, regardless of whether or not you're trying to lose weight, because a lot of these things aren't actually healthy for us, but they're good for our soul. And that's why I sort of term them soul foods. But I agree with you, Susie. I'm much more a fan of having my clients regularly included, but really tuning into your hunger and thinking, look, I just ate dinner. I'm not actually hungry. Like I would feel pretty sick. I'm much better regulator of my hunger and fullness signals these days than I used to be a few years ago. And I can easily say to myself, well, I'm not hungry, but I just want the taste and the pleasure of one or two squares. And I'm happy to just have one or two squares from the packet and put it back and that's it. And I might do that a few times a week. Versus if I sat there and ate half the block, I would honestly just feel sick afterwards. I feel bloated. I feel full. I feel just gross in myself and sluggish. And I just wouldn't enjoy it at the end of the day. So I think we really learn from experience. And I did a lot of that restricting, binging, overeating when I was a lot younger. And I just learned that afterwards, I don't feel great. So what's the point? And also with the skills of mindful eating, where one piece tastes exactly the same as 10 pieces. The taste never changes. But the satisfaction that we get if we're eating mindful is generally the highest in the first one, two, three squares. So I think it really does come down to those skills of allowing yourself to eat it. Don't restrict it, being super mindful with it and actually tasting it. So many of us just inhale it while we're distracted, while we're watching TV, while we're yelling at the kids, you know, while we're inhaling it, we're thinking, oh, I'm so naughty. I shouldn't be eating this. I have to be good tomorrow. And we don't actually taste it. So actually taste the chocolate and one or two squares, it'll taste as good, if not better, than what half the block actually tastes like if you just remove the restriction from it and allow yourself to eat it and allow yourself to enjoy that. But you're right, it really does come down to moderation and what else we're doing within the day as well.
If that is something you enjoy, really spend time at the supermarket looking at the flavors, the types. What do I get maximum pleasure from? Do I really like Lindt or do I actually really only like dairy milk? Or do I get, you know, think about what your body is craving and why. But the other trick I would share, and I think this is why some of the programs like the Quitting Sugar Movement seems to help people get control and reduce intake of those very sweet foods, because they often require you to go cold turkey. They help to break the pattern of having those foods every day. And so when you incorporate them again, it takes more time to build up that tolerance to have more and more. And that's why sometimes you'll have one or two squares and be satisfied, and others people will be eating the whole block because that's what their body is used to. So if you're someone who is an overeater of sweet food like this, like chocolate, I would suggest a break from it, similar to what happens when you're over-consuming alcohol, to reset your brain so you're not constantly looking for more and more and more. So that's another thing. You might need a week, 2 weeks to go cold turkey to remind yourself how much you're actually having and how little you actually need to get that pleasure and reset that marker. So if you're one of those people who has trouble, a break from it can be actually good to reset.
And we're all about buying in bulk and saving the extra dollars where we can, but soul foods and chocolate probably aren't those things that you should buy, you know, 3, 4, 5 packets of if they're on sale at the supermarket. Definitely stick to, you know, portion control. And I will always spend a little bit more money buying the brand of chocolate that I love the most and get the most satisfaction from, and then save big money on, you know, whatever other bread is on sale or rice is on sale or sauces or that sort of thing, or, you know, choose the fruit that's on sale in season. But of my soul foods, I'll always choose the one that I want the most to give me the most maximal satisfaction. So you get the most satisfaction from it, essentially. So I think that it's definitely not something we want to buy in bulk, and just be very mindful of the point of sale marketing at the checkouts as well, you know, and always, always, always eating soul foods and chocolates when you can be 100% attentive to them, not on the drive to pick up the kids in the car when you're at the lights and you're shoveling in a couple of mouthfuls, or, you know, in secret in your bedroom when everyone else is out in the lounge room or anything like that. Always be very open and be very aware of when you're eating these foods as well. Eating in the car should be a big no-no because it's the opposite of mindful eating. Again, your brain hasn't had time to pay attention to the fact that you've eaten something. Therefore, it doesn't really register it. Therefore, you want more and more and more. So just be really aware of when you're actually eating this chocolate as well. And I would even suggest if you want to have it at nighttime, that's absolutely okay, but do it in an ad break or turn off the TV or pause the movie so that you can pay 100% to the food that you're consuming so that you actually feel like you've consumed it and you don't want more and more and more of it. I think distraction is a real thing and it's a big driver of overeating for a lot of people. So just be really mindful of when and where you're consuming these types of foods as well. But absolutely, chocolate can be eaten daily. You can still be healthy, but it really does come down to the other things that you're eating and how much of it you're eating each day.
100%. If you know you can't stop after a row or two, don't buy the block. All right. Well, on that note, that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week. If you have not, please subscribe to have us delivered to your inbox each Sunday morning. And thank you for all the amazing reviews. We're really grateful. It helps us to make our way in the charts in the Apple Podcast app. We also have our Instagram and Facebook pages running at the Nutrition Couch Podcast for any of your questions or feedback. And we can't wait to see you same time, same place next Sunday. Thanks for listening.
Catch you next Sunday.